Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. This is the second episode in the series A Book, A Thousand Stories, that is inspired by Edmond de Waal's book, The Hare with Amber Eyes. As I said, this book is so rich in content that it inspires a quantity of different themes, hence the title of my radio series. So let us embark on telling some of the thousand stories that come to mind as we read through the pages of The Hare with Amber Eyes. In the summer of 1871, Léoné Frossi brings his family to Paris, where they settle in the newly built Hotel Effroussi at number 6 Rue de Monceau, on a highly colored hill in the 8th arrondissement. It is an area developed in the 1860s by Isaac and Émile Perrier, international financiers and property magnates, who had created colossal developments, railways, shipping lines, hotels and department stores. The Perriers re-landscaped the existing 18th century park in order to improve the views of the new houses around it. This was the park in which you could watch the great dames of the noble faubourg, the female illustration of La Haute Finance and La Haute Colonie Israélite promenade. Paris is a city still in trauma. The siege by the Russian army had only ended a few months before with the defeat of France and the declaration of the German Empire in the Hall of Millers in Versailles. The new Third Republic was shakily assailed by communards on the street and by factionalism in government.
The Franco-Prussian War of 1870 was easily the biggest blow delivered to France's prestige in modern history. It also brought France on the brink of a communist anarchist revolution. As military defeat was followed by a civil war that raged in Paris and lasted until May of the following year, it claimed 20,000 lives. The war itself was provoked by the Chancellor of Prussia, Otto von Bismarck, as part of his scheme to unite under Prussian leadership the reluctant southern German states into one strong Middle European power. It was a scheme he expected France to oppose, for reasons of balance of power. Now, until then, France, of the so-called Second Empire under Louis Napoleon Bonaparte III, was considered to be the prime continental European power, industrializing at a galloping pace at home and expanding rapidly its overseas empire in Africa, Asia and the Pacific. The Second Empire was ambitious and ostentatious, pleasure-loving, some would say even decadent. Its prestige was externally projected by such spectacles as the International Exposition of 1867 and, more concretely, the completion in 1869 of the Suez Canal, a massive coup of French civil engineering. So much did French primacy seem unassailable that France had no qualms going to war when provoked by Berlin in 1870. Evidently, French ostentation was not matched by military strength. As it turned out, the six-week war, topped by a four-month siege of Paris, was a devastating defeat for France, and for Parisians in particular. Humiliation was rubbed in by the imposition of a war indemnity of a staggering 5 billion francs, and German occupation of northern France until it was paid up. But the worst loss for France lay in the annexation by the new Germany of France's border mining provinces of Alsace and Lorraine, that's where Strasbourg is. A blow not just to French prestige, but also to France's industrializing capacity. Alsace-Lorraine, henceforth, became the prime symbol of hurt national pride and humiliation, to which loss the French neither did nor could ever reconcile themselves. It is no exaggeration to say that French politics, crippled for many years to come by internal political instability, would continue to be haunted by this loss and obsessed by the drive to recover the provinces, which they would at length, but after Germany's defeat in the First World War in 1918. Alsace, incidentally, but significantly in the particular context of this narrative, had a large Jewish population. The Jewish army captain Alfred Dreyfus, whose trial and conviction would make big headlines in France and Europe of the 1890s, hailed from Alsace.
So, once more, as in Vienna, this time in Paris, the Ephrussi build their grandiose house in a new area. There is noise, noise inside and noise outside, and all the windows are open onto the street. Léon is unwell, with a heart complaint, and the family have a terrible start to their life on this beautiful street. Betty, the youngest of Léon and Mina's four children, married to a young Jewish banker of unimpeachable suitability, dies within weeks of giving birth to a daughter, Fanny. The neighbors make out a list of big names among the newly arrived Jewish elite. 10 houses from the Ephrussi household lives Abraham Kamodo. His brother Nissim is at number 63, and their sister Rebecca at number 60. They have come to Paris from Constantinople by way of Venice. The banker Chernuski, great collector of Japanese treasures, has come from Italy. The Hotel Catani is home to Jewish bankers from Egypt, while Adolphe de Rothschild lives at number 43, where he has built a glass-roofed exhibition room for his Renaissance collection. It is a street full of people on display. Monceau is slang in Paris for nouveau riche. It is here, in the Hotel Ephrussi in Rue de Monceau, that we meet Charles Ephrussi. De Waal deeps deep into the character and sensibility of this ancestor, for it is he who, in his passion for collecting beautiful objets d'art, purchases the entire collection of 264 netsuke. De Waal is not quite sure whether these fascinating little objects were purchased one piece at a time, or whether Charles had purchased the whole collection from the dealer in Japanese art, Philippe Sichel. Who was Philippe Sichel? Philippe Sichel was a clever tradesman, an importer of things exotic, a salesman who bought Far Eastern objets d'art for $1 and sold them back in Paris for over 1,000 francs to avid collectors such as Charles Ephrussi and to many others, of course. From his travels in Japan, Sichel brought back exotic lacquered boxes, so light, so soft to touch, on which the artist had represented apple trees in blossom, sacred cranes flying across the water and topping over a mountain range, and people in flowing robes, gracious and elegant under their parasols. He wrote, "Japan was entirely new to me. If I speak frankly, I wasn't interested in the day-to-day life at all. All I wanted was to get the lacquers from the bazaars. In those days, Japan was a treasure trove of art objects to be had at a bargain. Even the passers-by would gladly sell the netsuke from their obi belts. The barrage of offers was so incessant that one was almost overwhelmed. Japan was to Sichel a box of sweets. A variety of different objects were much requested. Specifically, he knew, erotica were hunted with particular pleasure. Hence, de Goncourt, author and journalist, writes of his debauch, buying netsuke from Sichel together with chunga, prints of acrobatic sexual positions or bizarre encounters between courtesans and fantastical creatures. But back to Charles Froussy. Charles is but Léon and Mina's third son. The responsibility of developing and sustaining the family fortune does not sit on his shoulders. He will be free to introduce us to the new Paris of Baron Haussmann, who has raised medieval streets and created new parks and new boulevards. To the artists of the Impressionist Solidarity who struggle to receive recognition and for whom Charles will be patron and friend. To his lover Louise Kahn d'Anvers, and to the passion that they both cultivate, the collecting of Japanese artifacts. Says the Wall of Charles Froussy, "It was always the third son who leaves the home to go adventuring." Charles spent the first decade of his life in Odessa. The next decade was spent in Vienna, in the big home on the Ringstrasse. And now, in Paris, Charles is free to do what he wants. He has his new apartment in the family house, gilded and clean and empty. A new house on a newly paved Parisian hill. He has languages. He has money, he has time, and so he sets off wandering. Like a well-brought-up young man, Charles goes south. He goes to Italy. This is his grand tour. This journey turns Charles into a collector. He buys drawings and medallions, Renaissance enamels, and a marble child in the manner of Donatello. He buys a beautiful faience sculpture of a young fawn by Luca della Robbia. Madonna Blue and Yoki Yellow.
Luca della Robbia was a highly regarded figure of the early Italian Renaissance. He started off working as a sculptor in marble, but eventually specialized and fully mastered the art of glazed terracotta. His first work for the chapel of San Luca in Sant'Egidio in Florence in 1441 revealed a technique that would become characteristic of his future works. Roundel or lunette forms with a blue background, white figures carved in high relief, and the yellow and green border for the festoons that frame the work of art. No red glaze could be produced at the time, but Luca and his workshop would sometimes use purple. These distinctive colors were derived from mixing white glazes with oxides of various metals in finely powdered form. Once the terracotta sculptures were ready, they would be covered in delicate colored washes that would highlight features of the sculpture, such as clothing or details of fruit and flowers, very much in the same way that paints are used for painting. These colors were permanent and could be exposed to the weather. The Florentine sculptor covered his creations with a white glaze before baking, which, once complete, would make the works of art seem as though they were bathed in light. The end result were polished surfaces that reflected both light and color. Luca della Robbia's colors reflect the milky blue sky and the yolky yellow shades of the surrounding Tuscan countryside. His distinctive colors were also entwined with the religious and philosophical views of the early Renaissance. White was the color utilized to express purity and innocence. Blue symbolized the Immaculate Conception, and yellow was a remembrance of the spiritual world. Della Robbia's flowers, fruit, saints, Madonnas, and bambini were gracefully and delicately rendered, very much like Charles Effressy's Netsky. Charles was not the only individual in cosmopolitan Paris appreciative of these polychrome sculptures. Nelly Jacquemart and Edouard André visited Italy every year in the 1860s and amassed one of the most impressive collections of Luca della Robbia's art in France. They would eventually display it in their house, which was later converted into a museum. Charles would no doubt have been aware of this, being a collector himself. This demonstrates that collecting had become very much in vogue in Paris at the start of La Belle Époque.
Charles is but 23, and he brings back to his apartment all these crates of treasures, including a lit de parade, complete with high canopy, putti, heraldic emblems, flowers and fruits, a princeling's bed, decorated with the Effressy E, a bed from which to rule a city-state, give audiences, a bed to write sonnets in, certainly a bed to make love in. Charles's apartment in the Hotel Effressy in Rue Monceau is a stage set, and all the things he collects speak of knowledge, history lineage, of collecting itself. As the world delves into Charles's papers, his books, his letters, he discovers how the young man gradually develops into an art historian, a connoisseur. He starts to write a book on Dürer, and travels far and wide, searching archives, libraries, and odd places for every sketch, every scribble he can find, in order to do the German artist justice. Charles, de Waal tells us, has walked seemingly without effort into the formidable, fashionable salon of the day. There were many of these salons, Madame Strauss's salon, or Countess Grefful, or Madame Madeleine Lemaire. A salon consisted of a drawing room full of regular invited guests, meeting at a set time in the home of some grand lady hostess. Here, poets would meet, playwrights, painters, musicians, the odd politician, and of course the mondaines. the anti-Semitic novelist and diarist Edmond de Goncourt complained that the salons had become infested with Jews and Jewesses. He is jealous of the charming younger Froussi. He is jealous that Charles has become the young confidant of the elderly Princess Mathilde, the niece of Bonaparte. Charles has the knack of knowing the places where his conversation is welcomed, where his Jewishness is either acceptable or where it is overlooked. He begins to write for the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, whose offices are in Rue Favart. He meets other writers and artists and can make use of the best art library in Paris. The Gazette is a lavish publication with illustrations interleaved with tissue mounts. It is the perfect journal for an aesthete such as Charles to write for. Charles has a sense of himself as a scholar-collector. He is in the extraordinary position of being both ridiculously affluent and very self-directed. And he is in love. In love with a lady of the beau monde, Louise Caen d'Arvert. Louise is a couple of years older than Charles, and very pretty with red-gold hair. La Caen d'Anvers is married to a Jewish banker, and they have small children, four small children, a boy and three girls. The fifth child arrives, and Louise calls him Charles. Whether he admits it or not, de Goncourt is fascinated by her. Frequenting her salon, he wrote, "The Jews retain from their original Oriental origin a peculiar nonchalance. Today, I was charmed as I observed Madame Caen d'Anvers fishing in the bottom of her vitrine of porcelain and lacquer ware, wanting to hand me some. She moved like a lazy cat. And when they are blonde, these Jews, there is at the heart of their blondness something golden, like the painting of the mistress of Titian." This description by the king of the Parisian gossip pages gives us an idea of the charms of La Caen d'Anvers. Her eroticized langueur makes of her the muse of many an artist. She becomes la muse alpha for the artist Paul Bourget, and Carlos Duran, society painter of the time, portrays her barely contained in her swirling gown, her lips slightly parted. It makes the world wonder why she wanted an affair with Charles, the aesthetic young scholar.
Titian was one of the names dominating painting in Venice throughout the 16th century, and he had numerous elite patrons. In 1538, he was commissioned by the Duke of Urbino to paint what we now call the Venus of Urbino, which depicts a ravishing, flame-haired beauty in an advanced state of undress. The artist painted a woman who has red-gold hair, tumbling down over her creamy white shoulders, as she looks out quite brazenly at the viewer. It is very probable that Titian intended the nude as an erotically charged image and a deviation from the classical theme. The languorous beauty of this female nude inspired similar creations from the Venetian master. Danae, another of his nudes, is bathed in subtle golden light and belongs to the genre of erotic mythology created by the artist. Both these paintings capture the texture of the lady's flesh with great accuracy, There is an emotional quality in the palette utilized by Titian, a richness, a vibrancy that is not easily forgettable. So who was Titian's mistress mentioned by the famous Goncourt? Possibly the writer was aware of another painting of Titian in France at the time, and now housed at the Louvre. This work is entitled Woman with a Mirror. The sitter's cascading red-gold locks fall down over her left shoulder, and the male presence on the left-hand side of the painting holds a mirror to her face. The facial features of this striking woman resemble those of Flora, Titian's most iconic flame-haired beauty, and another of his famous paintings. It has been suggested that Flora was probably Titian's mistress Cecilia, and the mother of his two children. The artist finally married Cecilia in 1525 in order to legitimize their children. He portrayed her in numerous other works, which include another female portrait entitled Violante. The color Titian takes its name directly from this revered artist in recognition of his preference for ladies with this type of hair coloring. When Edouard Manet, who was a good friend of Charles Effrussi, painted A Modern Olympia in 1865, which was a modern take on the Venus of Urbino, he was making a controversial statement about the lax state of affairs in France at the time. Manet's nude, although directly referencing Titian, was more of a social commentary on the relationship between a courtesan and her gentleman patron. Was this what Goncourt had in mind when he compared Charles Effrussi's lover to a pretty woman with red-gold hair and who moved around lazily like a cat?
Charles becomes an assiduous presence in the inn salons of the city. Among them, Madame Madeleine Lemaire's Thursday Salon, mentioned by Marcel Proust as he evokes the scent of lilies filling her studio and drifting in the Rue de Monceau, crowded with the carriages of the beau monde. We shall get to know more about the Parisian beau monde and about Charles and Louise's bond next week. I am grateful to Professor Dominic Fennec and to Caroline Mijani for their expert contributions to this second episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories. My dear listeners, au revoir.